From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, an explosive lawsuit filed against Michigan State University alleges that Larry Nassar raped an MSU athlete in 1992, and former AD, now trustee, George Perlis covered it up.
They're alleging that essentially this young woman was hurt. They said that she went and tried to seek help, and it sounds like she didn't get help.
We talked to Candace Stearns, the GOP candidate for Michigan's 9th Congressional District.
I actually will make sure that I reach across the aisle on both sides to have real conversations with people and make sure that we can get some results.
And while we could get a great view of the Northern Lights tonight, thanks to some high-speed solar winds.
How high? About 600 kilometers per second or 1.3 million miles an hour.
Those stories and more today for you on Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today brings explosive new allegations in the Larry Nassar scandal at Michigan State University. A new lawsuit filed yesterday alleges that George Perlis, long affiliated with MSU, covered up allegations from a student athlete that Nassar drugged and raped her when she sought his care for a field hockey injury. The lawsuit claims this happened in 1992, before Nassar was a doctor, and when Perlis was MSU's athletic director and head football coach. The story was broken by Kim Kozlowski of the Detroit News, who's with us now. Kim, tell us about the suit and the woman who filed it.
The woman, her name is Erica Davis, and she is a resident of California. And she apparently was at MSU when she was 17 and was a field hockey player. And she saw Larry Nassar when she had injured her knee. She twisted her knee. Her coach suggested that she go and see Nassar because her coach knew Nassar through a mutual friend and knew that he was doing some sort of study and needed to see athletes.
And then what does the suit allege happened when she went to see Larry Nassar?
Well, he saw her and he wanted her to get consent, but said her coach could give consent since she was 17. And there was apparently a cameraman in the room when he was doing this alleged study. And initially, he did something with her that involved her giving her a breast examination and asked her to remove her shirt. And he did some other things. And then he asked her to come back the following week for what sounded like it might have been a pelvic exam. But he gave her some sort of pill, and he crushed it up, and he told her it was supposed to help her knee. And she became drowsy soon after. And according to the lawsuit, when she wasn't, she kind of became not woozy and saw that he was raping her. And she told some friends later that night. She apparently was in a lot of pain, and she also told her coach. It's unclear when she told her coach, but she told her coach, who confronted Nassar and demanded this video that apparently had recorded it. This is all according to the lawsuit. And the coach also confronted George Perlis.
And Perlis was MSU's athletic director during part of 1992.
That is correct. I have asked MSU when his last day was, because the lawsuit is a little nebulous on some time frames when this all occurred. It referred to it as spring. And Mary Lee Dean Baker did come in as MSU's athletic director. I just spoke with her, and she said it was either July or August.
Just so you know, we found a story from the Chicago Tribune about the whole tug of war between then-President John DiBiagio and Perlis. DiBiagio wanted him to not be football coach and AD at the same time. And that story, which was dated June 17th, said Mary Lee Dean Baker took over as athletic director in mid-May.
She told me she was named in mid-May, but she had to sell her house, and she wasn't clear exactly when she arrived at MSU. It was probably around July or August.
Okay.
But she also told me that she was not aware of this case at all. Keep in mind that the Detroit News did write a story at the height of the Nassar scandal, when all the young women had testified that she was calling upon them for transparency and accountability. So she has been, you know, someone who has been in the limelight as being, you know, MSU really needs to be accountable. But today she told me that she'd never heard about this, and some of the timeline wasn't quite making sense, because in the lawsuit, it alleges that the young woman had told her dorm mother that she wasn't feeling well and she had a pregnancy test. And she found out it was a positive pregnancy. And she did go to the police in October of 1992.
But she I want to just back up. When she first told friends and went to the coach, how did the school handle it? Where did the complaint go, according to the lawsuit?
That's not clear. It's not clear. Some of the timeline in the lawsuit and how it's written, it sounded like her coach was supportive of her and went and confronted Nassar and demanded to see this videotape. And apparently also complained to Perlis. Now, it's unclear when she complained to Perlis, but they said that he intervened and forced her to return this video, resign, and then sign a non-disclosure agreement.
And this is the coach we're talking about.
Yes. Now, this coach also, her name was Martha Ludwig, and I've not been able to reach her. She was also someone who Mary Lee Baker had never heard of, and she came in soon after. So it's not clear to me why she didn't know her. Maybe she had departed. Mary Lee Baker said, you know, I don't want to say this didn't happen, but she had never heard of this coach at the time. So there's questions a little bit about the timeline here, but these are what the allegations have laid out. The Attorney General's office did let me know that they were aware of the suit and they were investigating.
And going down then later in the year when the complainant said she found that she was pregnant, what happened there? You said she went to the police.
She did go to the police, and she told them that she had reported it to the athletic department. And apparently a detective told her that he basically had no power to investigate, and anything that took place in the athletic department needed to go to the athletic department. And that was when they heard that George Perlis is a powerful man and she should just drop it. But that was in October, and by then Mary Lee Baker had already been the athletic director for a few months at least.
I'm talking with the Detroit News reporter Kim Kozlowski about the story that broke today about a new lawsuit alleging abuse by Larry Nassar and an alleged cover-up by George Perlis, who was MSU's football coach and one-time athletic director and is still a member of the Board of Trustees. So has MSU responded today? Any comment from school authorities, Kim?
Yes, they did issue a statement today and basically apologized for all the trauma that all the sexual survivors have experienced and mentioned that they do have new protocols, procedures in place. You know, they're taking the allegations seriously and looking into the situation.
Bottom line, what is the suit alleging were the consequences of all of this?
Well, they're alleging that essentially this young woman was hurt. They said that she went and tried to seek help, and it sounds like she didn't get help. Her claims were taken seriously by a coach, but when the coach confronted Larry and asked for this video, it sounds like, allegedly, that George Perlis intervened and somehow made the situation go away.
You did use the term nebulous to describe some of the language in the suit, and we've noted errors. For example, the suit claims Nassar was a world-renowned doctor. In 1992, at that time, he was a graduate student with the School of Osteopathic Medicine. He was not even a DO by then. He had not been a doctor.
No, he had not. But keep in mind, the very first victim that we are aware of did occur in 1992. Her name is Sarah Klein. She had been anonymous up until the ESPY Awards very recently in July. And she alleged that he assaulted her when he was a medical student in 1992 and was doing kind of like some medical exams on her as well. And she came to his apartment and did some measurements on her from the floor and asked her to take a bath. And then he sexually assaulted her after that.
One other line that jumped out at me, a quote from the court documents in your Detroit News story, and I'll quote, Perlis intervened and the charges were dropped against the coach, but she was forced to return the video, resign, and sign a non-disclosure agreement. Are you clear what charges against Coach Martha is this suit referring to?
That was not clear in the lawsuit, and I did reach Brian McKean this morning, one of her lawyers, and he was in trial court and was unable to talk, and I have not yet been able to reach him since. Oh, and also this just in, Emily Grant, spokesperson for MSU, just said that George Perlis's end date was May 14th, 1992, and Mary Lee Dean Baker's start date was 5/15/1992.
Okay, so there was a couple of week of an interim. So May 14th, 1992. And it's unclear that you could deduce yet from this lawsuit as far as dates, hard dates, when things were complained about and to whom?
Yeah, the dates are a little nebulous. They do refer to springtime, 1992. And that is definitely around the time when George Perlis stepped down from his post, and Marilyn Dean Baker picked up the reins.
What about other attorneys for the plaintiff? Have you been able to reach any of them? How many of them, and are there other ones who are not in Michigan?
I have not been able to reach any of those lawyers yet. I did reach out to Nassar's lawyer, and she was not available for comment. The Attorney General's office, I think I may have already mentioned, is investigating.
Kim, what questions do you still have?
Well, one of the questions I wondered about, this did get filed as the deadline for lawsuits to be filed against MSU ended yesterday. This victim, she did apparently, according to the lawsuit, repress these memories until February. And I asked to interview her. I'd like to talk with her. I know that oftentimes it takes a long time for victims of sexual assault to come forward and, you know, share that they had been assaulted. But there have been others who have emailed me and wondered why she waited. So, you know, I'm not sure what she would say, but that's one of the questions we might ask. And we also want to clear up some of the timeline, too, with the victims, alleged victims lawsuit.
Kim Kozlowski, Detroit News. Kim, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Theater talk is still ahead as we put the spotlight on a play debuting this Thursday at Tipping Point Theater in Northville, the Miss Firecracker Contest.
It doesn't take a shot at beauty contests. What it does do is take a shot at kind of the cultural linkage we have between conventional beauty and power.
Reviews of professional plays on stages around the state comes up after the break. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. It is time for Theater Talk. David Kiley of Encore Michigan is back with us to talk about what's on offer from professional theater companies all around the state. And we're going to start out with a show that we couldn't get to the last time around, but there is still time for people to see it. And what do you want to talk about?
Yeah, there's actually plenty of time to see it. It's a show called Wild Party, The Wild Party, at the Dio Dinner Theater in Pinckney. And this is a play that ran off Broadway about 18 years ago and then got revived a couple of years ago with Michigan's own Sutton Foster.
Ah, Troy High School.
That's right. And now it's available for license. And Steve DeBrune, who is the director at Dio, he jumped on it. And Cynthia, it is some show. It is based on a narrative poem written in the 20s. And it will remind some people of kind of a mashup of Cabaret in Chicago with a little bit of Pagliacci mixed in.
Well.
that's kind of how I describe it. But it's darker than Chicago. It's a darker show. The music by Andrew Lippa really soars at times. And it's a bit of a sampler of musical styles. Cabaret, a little gospel styling. I hear some Sondheim influences in there. But let me just say, this is not a play for the kids.
Okay.
There are some very mature sexual themes that play out on stage. In fact, in my review, I kind of wondered how the folks up in Livingston County, who are the bread and butter of the Dio's audience, will react. Because it's kind of a conservative area up there. But still, I seriously recommend this show. Steve DeBrune and a terrific actress named Elizabeth Jaffe are the leads, and they absolutely slay it.
Well, let's get a sense of the music. This is actually Sutton Foster singing from a recording of one of her performances, and this is Let's Roll the Dice from The Wild Party.
Let's roll the dice. Let's roll the dice. for playing nice has run before the small hand hits the one. I've got to do, it must be done. And if it takes a smoking gun.
So I can tell you are excited about this show.
Yeah.
Very much. Now we head to Ann Arbor to Theater Nova.
Yeah, we have a Michigan premiere of a play called The Totalitarians by Peter Sennachtrieb. That's the playwright. Let's just say that the plot and thrust of this play will sound a little familiar. It's about a politician named Penelope Easter, and she's a candidate for high office. She's impulsive and crass, with a closet full of skeletons. She enlists the help of Francine, who is kind of a silver-tongued political operative, and the two embark on a madcap journey of sex, money, complete misrepresentation of facts, and a total lack of scruples on their way to political fame. It's a comedy. It's a dark comedy set in what the playwright describes as a post-truth world. And I kind of think this is a play emerging in a growing genre of plays that explore this idea of a post-truth world.
All right. It sounds it's hard to think that it's a comedy, but because I'm kind of almost hearing House of Cards.
A little bit, but you know, there's some humor in House of Cards.
Yeah, that's true, too. All right. Heading downriver to Trenton. What's going on there?
So from contemporary politics to a period piece entitled Ada and the Engine. And this is about a real person, Ada Lovelace, and she's the daughter of the poet Lord Byron. And she is credited with writing the first computer program, believe it or not, despite actually having a computer language even today that's named for her. She is a name largely lost to the ages outside the world of computer science. So here's what happened. Lovelace took Charles Babbage's plans for an analytical engine. And this is, you know, in the early to mid 1800s. And she was a writer and imagined more ways to use this device than Babbage did. She imagined and wrote how to use a machine to use and process information. That's a pretty advanced idea for the time of Byron, no less. I think it makes her a bit of a female Leonardo of her time. And that opens this weekend at the Open Book Theater in Trenton.
Okay, and now we head to Northville to the Tipping Point with a play opening September 13th. The Miss Firecracker Contest. I love the name.
Yeah, well, a lot of people remember the movie if they haven't seen the show. This is a play by Beth Henley. It was first done about 1980 and then was made into a film in the late 80s. The story follows a young woman of about 24 who's contending in an annual beauty contest. And the character, Carnell, she's had a bit of a sordid young life. And she's about 24, which is, you know, frankly, older for these kind of beauty contests. This play has been critically well received since it first went on. Audiences have been a little mixed. The history of this play and the movie is that a lot of people expect it to satirize these kind of beauty contests, which, you know, let's face it, it's a pretty vapid world. And many believe that they should be a thing of the past with rotary phones and, you know, and the rest of it. But this character, Carnell, she never goes along with that theme. In fact, the play, it's not the way it plays out. In fact, I think what it does is it doesn't take a shot at beauty contests. What it does do is take a shot at kind of the cultural linkage we have between conventional beauty and power. The idea that we reward people in general with money and fame based on their God-given looks rather than their character and brains.
All right. So that's the Miss Firecracker Contest over at the Tipping Point in Northville. And then finally, how much fun is School of Rock?
Right. It was in Detroit at the Fisher Theater last season. Now it's going to the Wharton Center in Lansing. Opens on September 18th. This is the musical version of the film about kind of a stoner rock band guitarist who impersonates his roommate to take a substitute teacher job for the semester at a private school because he needs the money. And the central character, Dewey Finn, he isn't much of a teacher, but he does win the kids over, and he rallies these junior high school students into a band. And it's great fun, totally appropriate to take the kids. Here's a little sound cut from the show to kind of give you a feeling.
Zach, you ever play electric guitar?
No, my dad won't let me.
Oh, really?
He thinks it's a waste of time.
Oh, yeah? Well, let's waste that time together, shall we?
Take a hold of your axe and try to pluck out this riff.
And that is fun. That's from the Broadway cast recording. And, of course, a lot of folks caught the original version, the film story version with Jack Black. And it great fun. So you can get details on these and other productions all around Michigan easily going to EncoreMichigan.com. It's all there for you. David Colley of Encore Michigan, thanks so much.
Thank you, Cynthia.
Music lovers in Southeast Michigan, you've got a very special chance, a chance to hear the music of Taiwan. That's because the National Chinese Orchestra of Taiwan will be performing five times in Southeast Michigan between September 13th and the 16th, including weekend performances at the Detroit Institute of Arts Taiwan Festival, which celebrates the DIA's soon-to-open Asian galleries. Let's get a preview of all of this as we welcome Dr. Teresa Chang, who's president of MITAI, Michigan Taiwanese American Organization. Good to have you here.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate the opportunity to speak to you and all the audience here.
Well, tell me, what is the significance of bringing the National Chinese Orchestra Taiwan to Michigan? I'm just wondering how often this happens.
Well, this is actually the first time ever we have an opportunity to bring these actually nationally owned premier Chinese orchestra over here in Michigan. Collectively, all the Asians, primarily in Southeast Michigan area, very excited about having them coming over because they are considered as the most premier orchestras that in Taiwan.
So this is a big deal.
Yes.
This is a big,
super big
deal.
Yes.
And I know NCO plays traditional Chinese music with traditional Chinese instruments. So talk to us some, Therese, about why maintaining this traditional music is so important to Taiwanese culture.
I believe that, you know, with what we have grown up, of course, I was born and raised in Taiwan and came to the States in 85. Of course, go to a University of Michigan, all that. One of the things is so important that for us to maintain these traditional Chinese instruments that, and be able to play in the culture in Taiwan, and for them to actually bring over to Michigan here to play is that sometimes we miss the home. We have family back in Taiwan, and folks in Taiwan truly enjoy this part of music, especially that when they are combining the Chinese traditional instruments along with the cultures that combine with the performance and plays, etc.
And for non-Chinese and non-Taiwanese audiences, what do they get from experiencing these musicians and this music?
Boy, this is actually, I think it's a very interesting combinations that we are bringing in this time here. It's because that there are so many similarity in between the two instruments, not all of them, but some, quite a few of them. For example, like a violin, along with erhu, which you know, perform with two strings. And, you know, we truly, you will see that actually during the concerts of the Thursday. And also the flute instruments, similar to the dizi, where we're also going to be playing actually at the University of Michigan concerts, which fall onto the September 13th on Thursday. So it would be very interesting. This is the first time we actually have this opportunity to say, boy, let's see what it actually looked like, what it sounded like, you know.
Well, for yes. people saying, I wonder what this sounds like, we're going to take a listen now. A lot of the orchestra's performance will be in collaboration with local groups. So we're going to hear a clip now that will be played with some U of M musicians called Spring Dawn in Yangming Mountain. Let's take a listen. A little about this song.
This song actually is representing the beautiful mountain in Taiwan. It's the Yangming Mountain, Yangming Shan, which is the most beautiful mountains in Taipei City. And most people would go there for exercise, to doing things. So you get to see the descriptions of how beautiful that song's been played. And this is going to be performed by concertmaster, Miss Jenlin Liu. She's such a joy. People just have to come to enjoy that.
Now, I know that as people listen to us talk about the National Chinese Orchestra Taiwan, that name might trip people up because people hear generally about tensions between China and Taiwan. Can you briefly just give us an idea of what is the conflict between China and Taiwan, and also how different is Taiwanese culture from Chinese culture?
Very good questions. As Michigan Taiwanese American organizations, of course, our missions, you know, is to bring a beautiful Taiwan music between two states,
sharing
and
the
basically,
cultures.
You know, between promoting the cultural exchange between the two residents in Michigan and in Taiwan. And so I do not basically, try to pay much attention in this end of it, but from what we like to do is that to make sure that we have an opportunity to, through this music, you know, and the culture exchanged, they also will have an opportunity to, you know, feel like we are actually should be working harmony together, should have a peace together.
Between China and Taiwan. I want to have people turn to, listen to a more celebratory track. This is Golden Snake Dance from Joyful Taiwan. And I understand, Teresa, that the Ann Arbor Chinese Traditional Music Ensemble will be joining the National Chinese Orchestra Taiwan to play this song at the Detroit Film Theater. How did these groups come to collaborate or to prepare to play with each other?
Almost every week, actually, every Sunday morning, they have formed a practice group and at the Pittsfield Townships. And this group has been actually in primarily the practice at the Martha Luther King's elementary school throughout the years. And by this year, because that, we have that opportunity to have a national Chinese orchestra from Taiwan that coming over, and we thought that would be great that to collaborate these two groups together. And NCO is greatly, appreciate this opportunity, as one of their mission is actually to educate and to bring the cultures, experiences over to the United States.
Well, they're certainly they're going to be very busy while they're here. On September 13th, the group will be at Eastern Michigan University in the afternoon at noon, and then later in the day at the University of Michigan School of Music, Britton Hall. Moving to the 14th of September, Oakland University in Rochester Hills. The 15th will be at the Detroit Film Theater right there at the Detroit Institute of Arts. And also the next day, the 16th at 3 p.m. right there in the Rivera Court at the Detroit Institute of Arts at 3 o'clock. So there will really be a chance for people to find the National Chinese Orchestra Taiwan on this tour.
Yes, definitely. We certainly appreciate this, having this experience, bringing this great cultural experience to everyone in our Michigan here.
So we've put a link with information on the performances by the National Chinese Orchestra Taiwan on their 2018 North American tour. We've got that at the stateside page at michiganradio.org. Dr. Teresa Chang, who's president of the MITAI, Michigan Taiwanese American Organization, thank you for being with us and sharing your excitement over this tour.
Thank you very, very much for having me here today.
Chemicals commonly known as PFAS are being discovered at more and more sites across our state. If you live near one of these contaminated places, you probably have questions and we want to hear them. Send us your question by going to the Stateside page at michiganradio.org. Simply tell us your name, where you live, how long you've been aware of PFAS contamination near you, and then ask your question. We will try to get answers for as many as we can. Again, send us your questions by going to the Stateside page at michiganradio.org. Up next, we talk with Republican Candace Stearns. She's running to take Congressman Sandra Levin's place as a representative for Michigan's 9th District.
I'm going to represent the hardworking, caring people who want to see their congressperson actually make a positive difference in the 9th and bring some of the tax dollars back to our district.
Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. Welcome back. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. For the first time in 35 years, Michigan's 9th Congressional District will soon be represented by someone who is not named Sandra Levin. The longtime congressman announced he's retiring at year's end. His son, Andy Levin, is running as the Democratic candidate, and we spoke with him on yesterday's show. On the Republican side of the ticket is Candace Stearns, who is with us now. Candace, welcome to Stateside.
Thanks for having me, Cynthia.
So what compelled you to make the choice to run for Congress and represent the 9th?
Well, I have been a working-class mom, wife, and small business owner for the past 20-some years, and I grew up right here in southeast Michigan. And I've worked very hard, and I've had my own good times and bad, just like a lot of the working-class families. And this is basically why I'm running. I'm going to represent the hardworking, caring people who want to see their congressperson actually make a positive difference in the 9th and bring some of the tax dollars back to our district.
Now, you've been in the insurance business and had, you know, your own small business, and you've got some 20 years in the insurance business. How has that experience, Candace, shaped your views on health care and our economy?
Well, originally, when I got into the insurance business back in the early 90s, I really was able to bring a lot of ideas and assistance to not only the individuals with tons of different choices in the kinds of health insurance they could purchase. But also, healthcare was a lot more affordable back then. I used to be able to sit down with a small business owner who typically would employ 10 to 20 employees, and I could sell them a traditional Blue Cross and Blue Shield plan for about $130 a family. And it was a plan that didn't have a network, that you had to see a certain doctor, and it was a plan with a $3 drug card. And those days have been gone now for quite some time.
And healthcare costs, I mean, the cost of delivering medicine and doing procedures, that's gone up a lot since the 1990s.
Sure. And I know the Affordable Care Act's original concept was to make healthcare affordable. But really what it did is it was just basically insurance reform, governmental compliance, and tax. That's really what was delivered. And we saw the effects of the full effects of the ACA on January 1st of 2014, when the majority of our health care plans had to go through changes and received about an 8% tax across the board, because there's about 10 different types of tax that have been built into our insurance plans. And although there were some good parts of the Affordable Care Act, like insurance companies can't discriminate against pre-existing conditions and things like that, those types of benefits I don't want to see removed. But there's quite a bit that can be removed from the ACA. And
Do you support repealing the ACA?
So at this point, I don't think the word repealing the ACA is the right approach. What has to really happen is we have to make changes and fixes to a lot of the legislation that's been added into it since it began. For example, there's quite a bit of transparency that's missing in medical costs themselves. When it comes to fee schedules and things of that nature, the American people don't often know what their cost of care is going to be until they receive a bill in the mail 2 weeks later. And that's a real problem. That's a real problem for all of us, especially those when we're sick. We don't feel like we have the opportunity to necessarily shop around. But if we could get clear-cut answers when we're making scheduled procedures, which a lot of our care is scheduled, then I think it would help the American people tremendously.
How do you lower health care costs, ensure people with pre-existing conditions are not denied coverage, and prevent the millions who did get coverage through the ACA from losing their health insurance?
Well, the people who are currently getting insurance, most of Americans get their health care through their employers. 155 million people get their health care through employers.
True, but there's many, many people who, thanks to Healthy Michigan, let's talk about that 670,000 some in Michigan who didn't have it, and thanks to Healthy Michigan, they do now.
Sure, sure, and I'm not necessarily saying that. We don't need to make changes to the program itself, because I think we do. I think we can make the healthcare itself a lot more affordable by looking at the actual fee schedules that are being charged, because these programs that are being subsidized currently by the state have different fee schedules that the providers and hospitals charge than they do, for example, in the private insurance market. And the way that you can help drive down cost is to actually make the actual providers compete and have some more free market within the actual medical field itself. For example, prescriptions are that way right now. When there's no one saying, hey, let's have a competitive bid process go on for something very commonly used for diabetics, for example, like insulin, then the pricing gets out of control because there isn't any competition within that, because people rely on the actual insurance plan to cover the majority of that stuff. And when there's a fix on the fee schedules, you're not going to be able to bring the pricing down.
I want to pivot over to spending. On your website, you write, "I'm ready to change Washington's spending addiction." And you also have said on the campaign you want to see more tax dollars being brought back to the ninth. What would you like to see more federal spending on for the ninth?
Well, we definitely need to take a look at the dollars that are coming back in infrastructure. Obviously, roads are a huge issue in Michigan, and as I'm spending time knocking doors and visiting the community, one of the top complaints that we have in Macomb and Oakland County are the roads. But we also need to be cognizant of the waterways that are underneath our roads, because some of these pipes and waterways are over 60 and 70 years old. So we're going to need infrastructure dollars, and we're going to need to make sure that the dollars that are available on the federal side actually come into Michigan. And we need a congressman, and we also need senators to fight for Michigan to see some of those dollars brought into our state.
To the point of your statement, "I'm ready to change Washington's spending addiction," I should point out the White House's Office of Management and Budget, the OMB, in its mid-year review said the federal budget deficit under President Trump is going to hit $1 trillion next year. The National Review notes Trump tax cuts have cut federal revenues by some $230 billion already and an expected $2.3 trillion over 10 years. And federal spending under President Trump is up by 7.5%, almost $300 billion. Republican Michigan Congressman Justin Amash tweeted the post-2016 Republican Party, in his words, has abandoned even the pretense of fiscal conservatism. What should we do about this?
Well, I think we need to take a look at the transparency and cost in all areas of government. Some of the biggest fraud, waste, and abuse is happening in our healthcare. And as a healthcare person, I can tell you that there's a lot of wasting and spending that's going on in our healthcare system. And that's one area that I think we can look at specifically that I have some experience in, and we can help reduce spending in that area. And healthcare happens to be almost 18% of our gross domestic product. So that's a huge area that we can look at and bring some transparency to and help reduce costs right there.
Do you support President Trump's tax cuts program and his spending, and would you welcome an endorsement from President Trump?
Absolutely. I appreciate what he's done with pushing forward the Jobs Act and tax cut that Congress signed in, and what that's done for us here locally in Warren specifically is Fiat Chrysler is bringing back 2,250 jobs into our area in the manufacturing world. So that's going to be a huge boost to our economy here locally in Macomb County, as well as other manufacturing jobs that are going to come from that just because of the Tier 1 and Tier 2 and Tier 3 suppliers that are in our area currently. And absolutely, I would welcome President Trump's endorsement.
There is an ongoing debate about immigration reform in our country. What reforms would you like to see?
Well, immigration is one of those huge areas, like healthcare, that needs an overhaul. In fact, a lot of attorneys and CPAs that I talk to will say that the immigration law is more complicated than our tax code, which in my opinion, says a lot coming from a CPA. and we really need to simplify immigration. I think immigration itself could be simplified by having three channels instead of five. For example, if we had skilled workers as a category, family-based relationships as a category, and then humanitarian refugee folks as a category, it would make it much easier for us to streamline the actual process to make legal immigration something that's obtainable for those who are coming from poor countries, for example. Currently, a person who's looking to get into the United States has to have an attorney and has to have dollars, you know, thousands of dollars to actually apply in most cases. And it makes it hard for them and kind of opens up that illegal way because, you know, not having dollars to get here and needing to have these funds and help from an attorney is a real barrier for people who are trying to come to the United States.
The country is very divided now, and it's stressing people out on all sides of the political spectrum. What role do you think elected leaders in Washington should be playing in bringing this country closer together?
You know, I had an opportunity to talk about community when I was at a Jewish forum just a couple of days ago, and they actually specifically asked me about hate and this visceral attitude that both people on the right and the left are having. And I really think as a community, we need to be kinder and have more empathy towards one another and actually have conversations. Everything starts with getting to know where another person's coming from. Until you've walked in that person's shoes, it's difficult for you to understand their perspective. And today, I think too many people are using our technology and our 240 character tweets to try to have meaningful conversation, and that's just not the way to go about it. When you have ideas that are as complicated as immigration and tax reform and healthcare, you're not going to get your ideas across in 240 characters. You need to be open to having a cup of coffee and having real dialogue and a conversation with people.
In our final few seconds, what are voters getting by choosing you over your opponent, Andy Levin?
I actually will make sure that I reach across the aisle on both sides to have real conversations with people and make sure that we can get some results and some things done. We don't have time to wait for a 2 to 3 year turnaround for people to actually have an opportunity to get some things done here. We need to bring results today, and we need to have the ability to walk across the aisle and say, we need to get things done in immigration. We need to get things done in healthcare, and we need to move the economy forward right now, because people rely on their paychecks every single week, and it's important for us to keep that in mind.
Candace Stearns, GOP candidate for Michigan's 9th Congressional District. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
If you are in northern Michigan, with a little luck, the rest of Michigan, eyes up tonight, because if skies are clear enough, you might see the northern lights, all thanks to a geomagnetic storm watch in effect. Justin Casper is with us, associate professor in the Department of Climate and Space Sciences and Engineering at the University of Michigan. So, Justin, let's talk space. When you see this magnificent light show in the sky, exactly what are we seeing? What is happening up there?
The sun gives off a very high-speed stream of particles called the solar wind, and that stream is also magnetized, so it carries the sun's magnetic field, and it goes all the way out past the planets, way past the solar system, creates a kind of protective cocoon that shields us from radiation from the rest of the galaxy. Now, you might imagine when there are solar flares and high levels of solar activity, some of those explosions and flares could impact Earth. We're actually entering solar minimum, so you might think this is a kind of boring, quiet period. But what's happening is the sun's setting up these very steady streams of high-speed wind. And about the beginning of today, a very high-speed stream suddenly kind of came over and pointed at Earth. The sun's rotating once every 27 days. And so as it turns, it sent this jet of high-speed wind to us. So about 24 hours ago, we started getting hit by this very high-speed wind. How high? About 600 kilometers per second, or 1.3 million miles an hour. That's twice the speed it normally flows at.
My mind just melted.
Yeah, exactly. And so what happens when that high-speed jet hits Earth? Often not much, because our magnetic field kind of stands up and protects us. But at the same time it jumped up in speed, the magnetic field in it actually pointed south in the opposite direction of Earth's magnetic field. And the impact of that is like peeling a shell off an onion. It basically ripped part of our outer protective magnetic shield off, and that allows radiation to start streaming in. Those particles come falling into high altitudes, and that's where you see the northern lights.
Oh, and they are stunning. Do you remember your first time seeing them?
I have never actually seen the Northern Lights myself. It is a big regret. It's actually one of the reasons I moved to Michigan 5 years ago, was I'm hoping to get to see that myself. So this is very exciting.
Get up I-75.
Exactly.
And should the skies be clear enough for people to see them tonight?
So it depends. Basically what happens is the stronger the event, the lower down in latitude it can reach. And so right now we're beginning to recover from the storm. And so if you're at very high northern latitudes, you stand a good chance of seeing a storm. What's interesting is the magnetic field's hovering right around zero right now, but the wind is still really high. If it decides to go south again, the whole system is basically primed. It's very unstable. And so then we could potentially see northern lights dipping all the way down past the southern boundary of Michigan. So please do, if it's clear near you, try and take a look outside tonight.
No matter where you live in Michigan, you might get lucky. Oh, that's kind of neat. I was jealous of the folks
up north. I know. They have it easier.
There are places, Justin, that are well known for their northern lights displays, Alaska, Iceland.
Right.
And we do get them sometimes in Michigan. What makes someplace a hot spot for auroras?
So basically, it gets back to this idea of the solar wind and its magnetic field are kind of stripping away Earth's protective magnetic shield. And that shield basically starts at the north and south magnetic pole. So it's easy for particles to come streaming in straight into the North Pole, straight into the magnetic South Pole. And then the stronger the event, the further down towards mid-latitudes it can reach. So there are some examples from 150 years ago of northern lights that were seen all the way down in the Caribbean. I don't think we're in store for that, but basically it's just a matter of what latitude you're at.
So fingers crossed, you're saying get outside. What would be an optimal time?
Oh, just as dark as possible. So I look closer to midnight just because you don't, you know, if the storm is dying off, you want to catch it as soon as possible.
All right. And lucky folks that live by the Dark Sky Park up north, because that should be quite the show.
Absolutely.
Justin Casper teaches in the Department of Climate and Space Sciences and Engineering at the University of Michigan. And I hope you get to see one soon.
Yes, me too. Thank you.
Today's Stateside was directed by Lindsay Scullin and engineered by Rusty Brock. Our executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Mike Blank, Mercedes Mejia, April Van Buren, Sam Corey, Joy Horan, and Sarah Leeson. Stateside's a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you for listening.